Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I'll begin with Bishop Nicholas Steno, who lived from 1638 to 1686. Nicholas Steno is often referred to as the father of geology. There's a really nice little book out there I just recently finished, which is why you're hearing about this, called The Seashell on the Mountaintop. Steno came up with our theory of geology, how landscapes change, because he started in seriously considering why is it that when you go up to some of the highest mountains in the world, you find fossils of seashells. And there were all sorts of different explanations for this. Some of them were that these were the beginnings of seashells that never finished, or things like that, right? Or that they were remnants of the flood. But Steno said, well, you know, the real reason for this is that these mountains used to be under the sea. And then he came up with four principles that are still used by geology today. Now, we might think that this is a weird blip, right? That, well, he just happened to get this right. But it should be noted that he came up with this theory at the same time when Steno, who was born in Lutheran Denmark, was becoming Catholic. And eventually kind of put aside his scientific research, he became a priest and then later a bishop. And during his time, and shortly after his time, people thought, read his work and then said, this can't be true. Even great enlightened thinkers, so-called, like Voltaire, thought that his ideas were crazy. But over time, as people began to do more research, especially in the late 18th, early 19th century, they began to realize that his ideas were correct and that the principles of geology that he established are still taught to students today. So that's the first counterexample. We have somebody who not only is the father of geology, but became a priest and became a Catholic at the same time as he was coming up with these theories. Second person, Gregor Mendel, who is often called the father of genetics. Right there, he, of course, is not the first person to recognize that there are inherited traits that are passed down from one generation to the next, but he's the first one to really test and come up with a model for this. And he was an Augustinian friar and lived from 1822 to 1884. And even today, in any science classroom, you can learn about his experiments with peas. And the third, and most important in my mind, is Father Georges Lemaître, who lived from 1894 to 1966. He's known as the father of the Big Bang. You know, in the early days of Einstein's fame, and then the beginnings of quantum physics, there were a lot of really interesting meetings of scientists throughout Europe and America, and Father Lemaître began to kind of, he was interested in physics, he was interested in the mathematics, and he thought that there was a lot to Einstein's theory of relativity. But he also recognized that there were some mathematical problems, and he came up with a solution that resulted in there being a single origin to the universe that then kind of expanded rapidly. And this theory at first was not believed by Einstein. It was even ridiculed by some. In fact, the name Big Bang was attributed to his theory as a pejorative, although now, of course, that's the name that we all use. And part of this invective against Father Lemaître was precisely because he was a priest. They thought that he was proposing this in order to make the idea of an origin and creation of the universe, as we saw in Genesis, more palatable. And so it was not until really his deathbed in 1966 that the alternative theories were put to rest, when finally there was the accidental discovery of the background background microwave radiation. And so I think these three figures, who are all priests and all deeply religious men, and also important contributors to the development of science, show an important fact, that science and faith are not only contrary, but quite often in the history of science, scientists and believers, or scientists and the church, worked together, and that in fact many scientists were and are deeply believing, committed Catholics and Christians. And so, although this narrative of the kind of battle between faith and reason is common, the facts are just false. that, in fact, when we look at the history of science and religion, they work together and, in fact, help to improve upon one another. And so with this idea in mind, the Thomistic Institute has, as you know, we send scholars to speak on different campuses. We have YouTube videos online. We try to show people that, in fact, science and faith collaborate very well together. We want to overturn this narrative and get scientists, philosophers, and theologians working together. We have given a title to this project. We call it the Scientia Project. Scientia being the term, the philosophical term for absolute knowledge that was also taken by the early scientists as a word to describe their own work as well. We understand that, of course, truth is one, and that no truth can contradict another truth. And so that if science is finding true things, then the truths that science finds cannot contradict the truths of philosophy or the faith, and vice versa. And in particular, because I'm a philosopher, I generally emphasize the importance of philosophy in helping to bridge the gap here. Because philosophy has a very important relationship with both theology and the sciences. In the traditional relationship between theology and philosophy is that philosophy acted as the handmaid of theology. That theology would take from philosophy certain aids, either principles from which the theologian can argue, conclusions that might be useful for consideration for the theologian, and even methods of argumentation. Theology and theologians make use of philosophy as an aid to come to conclusions about God. And as a result, much of theology is expressed in language that is borrowed from philosophy. And so philosophy is an important bridge between theology and the other sciences in the academy. But there's also been a traditional relationship between philosophy and science. You know, in the early days, it was only really in the beginning of the 20th century that we started referring to the experimental sciences, as we refer to them today. It was only in the 20th century that they began calling them science at large. Before, that type of work was normally associated with what they call natural philosophy. Natural philosophy was a branch of philosophy that studied the natural world. And so traditionally, philosophy, especially metaphysics, would supply natural philosophers with tools that they could use to examine the world, help them to have arguments, principles, and even methodologies of proof to show why certain experiments prove certain theories to be true. Or even giving the scientists tools to come up with theories and hypotheses which they can then go and test and discover whether or not these things are real. Now, while many philosophical principles have been explicitly pushed aside by contemporary science, nevertheless, many scientists inadvertently admit some philosophical principles into the construction and the development of their models and the considerations of physical problems today, both in mathematics, in physics, in biology, in chemistry, and all sorts of things. I think it's important that we bring back this relationship between philosophy and science so that scientists can have available to them the tools of philosophy to help to put together better models for examining the world around us. And that if we can do this, then philosophy can also help to bridge the gap between theology and the sciences and to enrich our understanding of how all three of these sciences can work together to understand creation as God has made it. Now, one thing we have to combat, though, is despair. I've come across plenty of scientists in the academy who say, how can you possibly think that people are going to do this? Some of them say, look, I just go to work, I do my thing, and then I go to church. Or I had a computer scientist throw up her hands a few weeks ago saying that, you know, there's just no hope. They're not going to buy into this. But I think that our work at the Thomistic Institute shows that it is possible to get theologians, philosophers, and scientists working together and collaborating on real projects of importance to all of us. And we have several different programs that we use for this. We have a science symposium every summer, which we'll have in just a few weeks. We're talking about light this summer. I've also started organizing these small groups of working groups that we're calling Scientia Salons in order to get scientists, philosophers, and theologians to have a common project. So Dr. Lunin and myself are on a project where we're just looking at theories of time to figure out if scientists and philosophers can come up with a coherent theory that would be helpful for scientists and, you know, understandable to philosophers. I also have another group that's working on trying to bring together theories of virtue with practice and counseling and psychology. And we have a few down the road. We might have one on light, we might have one for doctors. But regardless, the point of these salons are to bring scientists and philosophers and theologians together to have real conversations and then to overturn this narrative against about faith and science not working well together. And of course, we have met our many lecturers on faith and science on our speaker menu, many whom you can invite to your campuses, and I encourage you to do so. One of those speakers is, of course, Dr. Jonathan Lunin, who has spent a semester here with us in Washington, D.C., and he's in high demand and helps to illumine how astronomy gives us insight into the origins of the universe and how that works with theology. So please look at our list. Consider bringing scientists to your campus to get those conversations started. With that, I'm going to let Dr. Lunin talk a little bit about his experience in this project.
Thank you very much, Father. We would, by the way, very much like to make this a panel discussion, so we expect some very challenging and penetrating questions for the final half hour. And I was fiddling with my phone to make sure that I could stay on time here. I was not reading my email, although we once had a speaker at Cornell who was reading her email during the question and answer portion.
Was she responding to?
She was, and she was reading her email right down at the podium. Very famous physicist. Okay, so how many of you are budding scientists or scientists in actuality? Great. One of the saddest things I ever heard was after giving a talk on evolution at my parish, one of the youth group students who was in high school came up to me and said to me that this talk was very comforting for her because she was really interested in science, but her boyfriend had told her that she couldn't be a scientist and believe in God. Just think about that for a moment. Now, her boyfriend was not a famous philosopher. Her boyfriend was another high school student. There's nothing wrong with high school students. Their knowledge and experience base and the number of neuronal connections in their forebrains are still limited. But I tried to expand upon the point of my talk with her, and she ended up in the end majoring in college in history, which is a fine subject, but we lost her from science. So the conflict narrative is very much still out there. And one of my own goals is to try as much as possible to reach young people, to young people of faith, Catholic faith, but also Christian, Jewish, whatever, to really talk to them about where they think the conflict lies and how many of those presumptions really are simply not true, as Father said. Now, this is a session on being a Thomist and a scientist. Is that right? Something like that. So I just want to make sure everybody knows the following. I've been a human being, actually as of last Thursday, for 65 years and 9 months.
Happy birthday.
Thank you very much. I've been a scientist for 40 of those years. I've been a Catholic for 17 of those years. And I've understood Thomism for brief periods within the last 2 years or so. It's been incredibly difficult. There's nothing wrong with St. Thomas. It's what's wrong with me, that trying to rewire my own brain late in life has been really very difficult. Just struggling to be able to use the terms that St. Thomas used, either Aristotelian or his own, are really difficult if you don't have the background and the education when you're young. And I'm saying this to make a point, which I'll get to in a couple of minutes, about our experience with our first Scientia Salon and some of my colleagues. So Father has given us examples of scientists who are also religious. I want to give one more example, and I want to say one other thing about Gregor Mendel. His contribution is often not fully appreciated. His contribution in some ways stands, I wouldn't say equal to, but of the same order of magnitude as that of Charles Darwin in terms of making the theory of evolution a sensible theory. And the reason is the following, that what Darwin did, and he deserves full credit for it, was to develop the whole idea of natural selection, descent with modification, that speciation occurs from members of other species when the environment, the living in and competition within the natural environment leads to certain traits being favored. What Darwin didn't understand was how those traits are transmitted. And in fact, he had a model for the transmission of traits, which was entirely wrong. It was the Gemmule model. I don't have time to go into it. Gregor Mendel, in addition to his experiments with pea pods and other plants, came up with the correct model for the transmission of traits through the sex cells, the gametes. And he wrote this, the paper that he wrote in which he described the plant experiments, one of the papers, also includes that. And that is often forgotten. And he had sent a copy of that paper to Darwin. And that paper, in its unopened envelope, was found in Charles Darwin's study after Darwin had died. It was one of the things that was on his desk. It had never been opened. It was forgotten for decades until in the early 20th century, an English biologist caught wind of it. Of course, it had been written in German and translated it. And then this was sort of rewritten in another paper by two other biologists who recognized Mendel's contribution. And that really was the missing piece to making the idea of evolution a sensible one. And there is speculation, Francisco Ayala in one of his books has talked about this, that perhaps the fact that evolution really didn't have a viable mechanism for decades into the 20th century, at least one that people, you know, had remembered or recognized because Mendel was forgotten in that regard, that perhaps it might have been more fully accepted early on. So his contribution was enormous. It was not just in the plant experiments. Now, let me talk a little bit about my experience with Thomism and science. When I came here last year as the MacDonald Agape visiting scholar, and I was very grateful to the MacDonald Foundation and Peter MacDonald for sponsoring this, and Father Dominic Legg for nominating me as the inaugural visiting scholar, one of my tasks was to teach a course in astronomy to the student brothers and others who were taking degrees here on astronomy, but astronomy with the exploration of some of the theological ideas that connected with science, that would be inspired by discoveries in science or vice versa. And the course was entitled Knowing the Cosmos, and Father Dominic was the co-instructor. It was, for me, a very exciting experience. It was very challenging to take an astronomy course and pare it down because I only had 3 hours a week, and some of that we devoted to the theological discussions. But I had a lot of trouble grasping the connections between the astronomy that I was teaching and some of the theological topics that we were trying to engage in. And I think that's often the case for others in science who have some familiarity with theology. What really cracked this open for me personally was a discussion with Father Ambrose in which he introduced me to a book written by Michael Dodd, who's a very prominent Dominican theologian, philosopher, he is still alive, entitled Unlocking Divine Action. And it was written about 2009, I think. It's an excellent book. I strongly recommend it. It explored the question of causality in science and causality as St. Thomas understood it. And it really traces a narrative, I think, that's very important for understanding how theology and philosophy can inform science. And the narrative goes something like this, that in the Newtonian revolution, the mechanistic revolution of the 1700s and 1800s, scientists actually consciously, especially in the 1700s, because then they were classically trained, wanted to get rid of at least three of the four Aristotelian causes, material cause, formal cause, final cause, leaving behind only the one cause, which was the mechanistic one. And so there was essentially a constriction of everything to the material, if you will, the efficient cause. And in fact, taken to the extreme, there have been attempts to even eliminate that there are no causes at all, that one thing doesn't cause another to happen. But even leaving in the efficient cause essentially gave no room for the action of God. If everything was all about atoms pushing and pulling on each other, then where does God actually fit in? And of course, there's the famous idea that if one knew all of the boundary conditions at the beginning of the universe, you could predict everything that went on just using the laws of Newtonian mechanics and electromagnetism and so forth. Of course, that all came to an end in the early to mid part of the 20th century with quantum mechanics in particular, and then with the notion that arose during the 50s and 60s of something called emergence, where complex physical systems have behaviors that cannot be predicted simply by knowing what is happening at the ultimate reduced bottom, the motions of the atoms and molecules themselves, that there are behaviors, and in particular, evolution of physical systems, that are the result of this complexity, but in a way that is difficult to understand. Certainly that this efficient causality doesn't really give you any understanding. And furthermore, within that time period, the theory of evolution, biological evolution, really is difficult to explain and comprehend without thinking of, in essence, a final cause for the way that certain behaviors and patterns and biological structures arise. Biologists try mightily to avoid that, but inevitably they're not very successful. And so if you just take some example of the evolutionary development of something and try to express it with no teleology whatsoever, it becomes a real mind bender. It's very difficult to do. So with complex systems and the evolution of function, one is now in a situation where efficient causality is not enough. So does that mean that God is in the emergent properties? Well, Michael Dodd argues that that's not a really good way of looking at things, because it puts God on the same par with his creatures. That if you say that God is in the quantum mechanics, that God works when the wave function hasn't collapsed yet, or God is in the complexity of a system and pushes it toward the emergent properties, then God's causality is univocal with those of his creatures. It's like having two people who are at each end of a table and lifting the table and moving it across the room, as some of us saw earlier when Father Ambrose was setting all of this up. And so Thomistic philosophy and theology makes it very clear that that is not the way that God works in the world, that God is a primary cause, and the physical systems and processes and laws and so forth are all secondary causes. So a better analogy would be, and I know I only have a couple of minutes left, better analogy would be writing on a chalkboard the words, "I believe in the Trinity." The chalk has written those words as the secondary cause. The physics is in the marking of the blackboard with the white material in a shape that gives meaning to that sentence if you understand English. But you, as the holder of the chalk and thinking of this thought and composing it, are really the primary cause. Now, that's a very approximate kind of example, because God is even more remote in being the primary cause than the human being writing on the board and the chalk being the secondary cause. But for me, it's very helpful to think about it that way. And it, to me, provides an extension to something that came out of the Scientia Salon that Father Ambrose talked about, which was a question and eventually a paper on the issue of why the universe becomes more ordered, why physical systems within the universe arise that are more ordered, that have more functionality, that have more information in them, even as the universe itself is undergoing this evolution toward increasing entropy, toward overall increasing disorder or less information. And we invited scientists, my colleagues from the Carnegie Institute of Science here in Washington, D.C. They're working on a paper postulating a missing law that eventually did get published. What we found was that in the period of time that we had for this salon, trying to educate them in the Thomistic language of causality was very difficult. There just wasn't enough time. And so much of the conversation really arose around misunderstandings or trying to grasp an understanding of the question of primary and secondary causes, of the question of purpose used in the Thomistic sense. But those conversations were extremely valuable. It actually helped the paper to get published, and I can describe a little bit about how that happened in the Q&A, because I know I'm running out of time. But the punchline in all of this is that one of the two Carnegie scientists that we invited, the senior person, who I've known for many decades, recently did a video on this paper for the Templeton Foundation, and concluded the video by asking whether, in fact, evolving systems, as they become more complex, as they become more functional, might in some way express the property of purpose, which I thought was a kind of a victory for our salon exercises, because there was a great effort to avoid those kinds of terms beforehand. So the lesson in all this is that it takes a long time to really learn the language of Thomism and be able to have worthwhile discussions with your scientific colleagues about some of these important issues. And I'm still struggling with it myself, as you can certainly see here. But those exercises convinced me even more that science and theology and philosophy are really all tied together, that they're part of the effort of the human mind to understand where it came from, to take, in effect, the intellectual journey home toward God, even as we also take the spiritual and faith-filled journey home. And I want to also say that there are a few things that some lessons I would draw about my experience with being a Catholic scientist and becoming a Catholic scientist after years of just being a scientist. I do my science independent of my faith and philosophy. Science is a process. It's a little bit like plumbing, right? A Christian plumber works the same way as a Jewish plumber or a Hindu plumber. But at least in science, you create things that are beautiful. I suppose a plumber does too, if, you know, the plumbing is all hangs together. And so, like a painter standing back and admiring her painting, there's a certain depth of appreciation that my faith gives me in understanding the results of science. And that is an enrichment that is, to me, something that's very important. The second is that doing science in alignment with the virtues of our faith is even more important now. I'm more conscious of the question of transparency and honesty and humility, even when I fail in it. But those are virtues that come from our faith that need to be applied in science today, because science has serious problems in those regards. And finally, I would say, know why science and faith aren't in conflict. If you are a budding scientist, it's very important to educate yourself in such a way that you can answer questions of critics and skeptics intelligently, even just by giving examples of scientists who are faithful, but even better, digging into some of the claims that people make that certain discoveries in science disprove the existence of God. There are no discoveries in science that do that today at all in any way, but being able to explain that intelligently is very, very important. And so I've gone over time. I will stop there and look forward to questions. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org /donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.